session number 23228, reel 4.
Professor Hugh de Wardener, reel 4.
And as I say, you get over it. And I'm talking about amoebic dysentery, aren't I? And that remains on and is very famous for being chronic. Sometimes it's associated just with ill health. And you don't realize how ill you've been for the last 2 or 3 years until somebody discovers that the reason you're not feeling well is that you have chronic amoebic dysentery without the diarrhea.
Why are you getting all these cases coming through so quickly?
Well, a breakdown of organization. I mean, there are flies about. Dysentery is always around in the tropics. And lands on a bit of food, and away you go. I mean, it's fecal contamination, usually through flies. But, of course, you can have it fecal from somebody the cook doesn't wash his hand. He's got it, and so on.
So it's sanitation, really, isn't
it? Yes,
it?
Yes, sanitation, yes. You better ask me a question. Where am I?
Yes, you were saying you were in charge. You were now able
right.
At last, your aim.
My first research project. That's right. And so I wandered about. It became quite clear that there were three things going on. First, there were one or two cases of encephalitis lethargica, which is a virus of encephalitis and lethargy, but lethargica, encephalitis. Very few, but there was cloudiness of consciousness, neck stiffness, and then death eventually. Then there was a form of vitamin deficiency, a vitamin B deficiency, where you had blindness, sore feet, and a few other things, and also mental clouding. And thirdly, there was this strange condition called Wernicke's encephalopathy. Wernicke, W-E-R-N-I-C-K-E, encephalopathy. Now, I had never seen it. But we had a pathologist called Lennox, Bernard Lennox, from Newcastle. He had seen it. And he was able, at post-mortem, to say definitely, this is Wernicke's encephalopathy. That was very important, his contribution. Now, nobody knew before the war what Wernicke's encephalopathy was due to, but there was a general feeling it was probably due to B deficiency. It occurred particularly in alcoholics, long-standing alcoholics, and occasionally in women who vomited at pregnancy, but vomited, couldn't eat. And so that way it was left when we became prisoners of war. Well, here we were, obviously in a vitamin B deficiency situation. There were a lot of B deficiencies began to appear, particularly in a dysentery wing. And there was no alcohol. So it was very likely it was due to B deficiency. And so I began, and the symptoms, a variety of symptoms, but the outstanding sign, which is the important thing, is nystagmus, which I mentioned earlier on in this talk. But here you had to ask a person to look to the side. And when you normally look to the side, you look to the side and your gaze is steady. But with nystagmus, your eyes begin to flicker as you look to the side. No, not with your whole head. Just you keep your head looking to the front and you look to the side with your eyes. And if you have nystagmus, you look to the side and then the eyes waver back to the center. And this was the earliest sign of Wernicke's encephalopathy. Then the next signs were signs of cerebral dysfunction, loss of memory for recent events, anxiety, total loss of appetite, absolutely. And that, of course, is common of any B deficiency, any form. B deficiency, you have no appetite. So terribly easy if you're ever asked, has this person got B deficiency? You just ask the patient if they're hungry. If they say yes, you know they haven't got B deficiency. It's that easy. But with Wernicke's, it's an antipathy to food. I mean, a real loathing of food. And the loss of memory for recent events then slips into a loss of memory for remote events, and then gradually confabulation, as it's called, when the person begins to make up stories. And the reason he's making up stories is he doesn't want to let on that he's lost his memory. And so that if you know about this, you can more or less push the symptom out of him by asking him questions and encouraging him to confabulate, which is rather naughty, but it sort of fixes the diagnosis. There are all sorts of examples that I came across. I mean, I remember one man had his gold watch stolen off him during the night. Well, in the morning, of course, he made a big fuss about it. By midday, he remembered he'd lost his gold watch, but he couldn't remember when. And by that evening, he'd forgotten he'd lost the gold watch. That was sort of a vague, clear example. It shows how often I was going around, continuously around. And then from the point of view of confabulation, there were people who didn't know where they were. I mean, they thought they were back in England, disorientation. And confabulation, I remember having a long conversation with one bloke, and I led him on a bit, and I said, didn't I see you in Brighton? Oh, yes. And I said, we went riding. Yes, you rode a white horse. And I said, I rode a black one. So, and there he was. They're trying to hide the fact that they can't. I think a person with Wernicke's is terribly worried and about what he knows. He feels something terrible is going on. And he can't express it. He doesn't want to tell anybody because that's letting on. And eventually, it's absolutely classical of a Wernicke's. They lie in bed, flat in bed, eyes closed. The eyes are closed because when they look, the nystagmus is now so bad that the scenery is wavering. So their eyes are closed, and their hands above the bed, and they're not saying anything. That is classical. If you're asked to see a case of Wernicke's, you see that, that's it. I mean, you hardly have to examine them. It's so clear. Now, my job, we had a box of vitamin B1 ampoules. A box. And each ampoule had 2 milligrams. Now you have tablets that have 20 milligrams. You have ampoules that have 100 milligrams. And you give it like water. But here was this box. And the idea was to use this box on those patients who I felt were going to go over the top. Because if you let it go too far, then the next stage is coma and death. And also I discovered that if you let them get into loss of memory for remote events, it took a very long time to recover, several weeks or months. I didn't know that, but I could see they wouldn't recover. They weren't recovering quickly. So my job was to go around and try and find which, spot the Wernicke's, follow them along, and treat them very early enough to, I mean, some of them would recover spontaneously by giving them a bit of Marmite or extra food or something. But usually they needed a little. And the giving B1 was amazing. There's 2 milligrams. Within a few hours, they had developed the most ravenous appetite. Ravenous. They couldn't eat enough. And of course, then the amount of carbohydrate they were eating would trigger off all the symptoms again because they didn't have enough B1 to metabolize all this extra carbohydrate. So you'd go in and out of it. And if their memory for remote events hadn't gone, their memory for recent events would come back within a few days and the anxiety would disappear and they'd be better. So I think it was quite a useful thing that one did for that, saved a few lives. Mm-hmm.
This B1, you know, the resource that you had.
The what?
How much of that did you have of the B1 vitamin?
Well, we had this box, which had about, I should think, about 40 ampoules. That was it.
And that was your finite.
That was it. That was it. That's the point, you see. So one couldn't just treat everybody who might have it. I mean, if we had plenty of B1, we'd give it to everybody, wouldn't we? Because there were plenty. I mean, quite apart from the Wernicke's, there was cardiac beriberi and uritic beriberi and so on. I mean, there were obvious signs of vitamin deficiencies around.
How quickly did this happen after the surrender?
What sort of time? About 6 weeks. six it's weeks to 2 months, yeah, something like that. Very quick. You see, the rice was polished, which removes all the B1 from it. And at first, there wasn't very much other food to eat. And then the dysentery, of course, you stop eating. And you metabolize more so that you precipitate the deficiency. So it's amongst the dysentery, it's mainly amongst, not always. And I collected together case notes of 52 cases. No, it weren't 52, there were about 46 cases there. 46 cases of Wernicke's encephalopathy. And I brought all the papers back. In fact, I gave them to somebody who was terribly interested in it. You probably heard from him, didn't you? Hasn't somebody been in touch with you? I gave him my notes because I didn't know what to do with them. I thought I ought to give them to somebody who was interested.
So you were able to peek those through the...
Oh, yeah, well, that's another story. That's a big story. I carried them around with me. And that occupied my time. It was very, very, very interesting. I enjoyed that part. I mean, as a doctor, what could I have more? Here I was doing research on something which was not known. I was contributing. I was treating patients. They were feeling better. I mean, come on, what more do you want? During my time at Changi, one or two sort of notable things happened. I developed a theory of my foot. I played goal. We played football. I played goal, and of course, I played on very dry earth. I did a miraculous save, I suppose, and I took the skin off the top of my foot. And we had at the bottom of the block a little room in which there were two or three cases of diphtheria. And I imagine the dust from the floor must have blown under the door into the passage and gone straight onto my foot. Anyhow, I developed diphtheria of this open space. And that was very painful, very, very painful. And I was cured by, because what was happening then was somebody else was doing it, they were taking the blood off patients who'd had diphtheria just recently and taking the serum off and giving it to the patients with acute diphtheria. Now, it wasn't terribly good for the throat, the severe cases, but for skin diphtheria, it was marvelous. Absolutely wonderful. I mean, I was given this stuff, and within a few hours, it stopped hurting. Just like that. Wonderful. And I think it was quite useful for me to have had diphtheria, because as you hear later, I got involved with diphtheria later, and I had a good immunity, I think. That was one thing. And another very notable thing, which I'd never forgotten. Next to me, sleeping in where the officers slept, right up at the top, was Colonel Julian Taylor, who was a brain surgeon from University College Hospital. He was a sort of bird-like man, sweet, very precise. And every night I'd come back from a ward round, or doing my work, and we would chat. And that's when I really learnt about academic work. Because every time I said something, he said, "Why?" Why? I got fed up with this. But I realized, of course, he was right. And he used to sit on the edge of his bed, rather like a sparrow on the twig, leaning forward with his glasses halfway down his nose, saying, "Why?" He was extremely erudite. He gave us 10 lectures, 1 hour each, on the French Revolution, without a book. Now, come on. 10 lectures on the French Revolution without a book. And they were fascinating. And I remember another thing about those lectures. As my name began with De, it was thought that I was the suitable person to give a vote of thanks at the end. So I burnished up a few good phrases and little jokes. He was my next-door neighbor in this dormitory of ours. And when he finished, I got up and I said, "I'm sure we all want to thank..." Couldn't think of his name. I had forgotten his name. And the front row were going, "Taylor, Taylor." And all that was going in my ears, whoosh, 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 awful rushing wood. Well, of course, I staggered on, but it was a fiasco. And from that moment on, I have never been able to remember a name on trying to introduce anybody. A curtain comes down as soon as I try to think of a name. Of course, now I'm old. I have an excuse. But for years in my department, if a VIP came around, And I hesitated. The person I was trying to introduce would put his hand forward and give his name quickly so as to cover up my deficiency. And that stemmed from those lectures. I've never forgotten it. Right. Well, at the end of about the end of 42, I was finally chosen to go up country. That is, to go to Siam. We weren't certain what we were going to. I don't remember anything about building a railway. But I don't remember. There are all sorts of euphemisms which other people have remembered, which I can't remember at all. We were going to go in a garden or grow vegetables or something or other. But anyhow, off we went. I followed a principle in the army, which I learned very early on. Never volunteer for anything and never try and get out of anything. So then whatever happens to you, it isn't your fault. And I didn't try and get out of this and stay behind. A lot of people did and managed to stay behind, you know, for one reason or another. And looking back, I was grateful for that I didn't. And we went up in these rubber trucks up to Siam, and that wasn't a very comfortable journey because rubber trucks are steel and two openings, one on each side, big openings. And of course we had them open, but there were a lot of people in each truck. And if you wanted to relieve yourself, you had to be held. I mean, as everybody, a lot of people had dysentery. They had to be held. They had their feet on the edge and with their hands like that, and it would be held over the side. So there was a lot of that going on. And then there were the friendly Malays who were throwing pineapples at us. Well, that was very nice to throw a pineapple, but if you're going at 30, 40 miles an hour in a train and you're hit by a pineapple, so we had to have sentinels on the gates to make certain that they'd catch them on their way in. When we got to Kuala Lumpur, we stopped. And we were there quite a long time, which was hot and unpleasant. And I remember that was my one view of KL from the goods yard. Then we went on to, we got into Siam, and we unloaded at a place called Bampong. And I think the railway then went on to Bangkok, turned right, went on to Bangkok. And I don't know how we went from Bampong further on. I think we either walked, I don't remember. I remember Bampong as being a very unpleasant place. This was the first time we'd met these long attap huts. Attap, you know what attap is? It's made of tiles. Tiles made of, they're tiles made of date leaves. A date leaf is a long, thin thing. If you fold it over a stick, and you fold a lot of them over a stick, you eventually get a thing like a tile. And then you put one of these things, one on top of each other, on a roof, and you have a very good leak-proof roof, which allows the air to go through it, the hot air to go through it. So they're excellent from the point of view of tropics. But, the problem was that the end of the hut, which we were in, was flooded. And there was detritus and feces and I don't know what else, and dead cats at the bottom. It was a very depressing couple of days, I remember being there. But somehow we moved on, and I don't remember crossing the river, the whatever it's called, you know, the famous river, Maklong Kwanoi, we were on. I don't remember crossing that. We then went to Chiang Kai. That's my first big memory of in Siam. And when I got there, there was the hospital section, which was mainly dysentery, but there was a little diphtheria ward. And, not so small either. It was quite a good epidemic going on. And I was put in charge of it. I'm not quite sure why. I was put in charge. And there wasn't much we could do except produce this serum, which we did, and give them. But the death rate had been quite high, I gathered. And the only thing I remember reading about diphtheria was that they mustn't sit up. Now, I remember the reading that. But they mustn't sit up. I did know that one of the complications of diphtheria is that your heart suddenly stops. Boom. Just like that. And the slightest exertion was inclined to do it. And I remembered this. I just remembered it. So as soon as I got in, I said, everybody lie flat. And don't you sit up. Well, of course, this was a big order to ask people to do that, because they were sleeping on what were known as slats. This is a piece of bamboo, big bamboo, that is opened out into a sort of plank of bamboo, if you see what I mean. And then they're put as a platform on each side of the hut. And the hut may be 50 yards long. And so that's what people slept on. And they're not uncomfortable. If you get a good slat, which has a certain give, not uncomfortable. But of course, it's full of bed bugs and full of lice. And there were plenty of mosquitoes. So to ask a person to lie still, at least not to sit up, while they've got diarrhea probably from dysentery, and so on, that was not much fun. But one poor fellow wanted to stretch his legs or something 2 days after I got there, sat up, put his legs over the platform and died. This had a very magnificent effect on the others. And the mortality from then on went right down. Yeah. A great friend of mine I met there called Peter Brookman. Peter Brookman was an officer in the Surreys, and he had volunteered to work in the dip ward, which I think was quite brave of him. You know, it's all right as a doctor, that's what you're there for, but he volunteered to work in the dip ward. He tells me, I'd only found out the other day, that he was the sister of the ward. He was in charge of it. Surprised me a bit. And he said, do tell her, because I told him that I was coming to talk to you, he said, do tell her, remind her about my famous automatic disposable bedpan. We had one bedpan for the whole ward. And what he did, he put a big banana leaf on it. And then he'd take the bedpan with a flick of the wrist, was able to get rid of the leaf. And the bedpan didn't get dirty, which was very cool. And I was there for... That epidemic lasted a good while. We had trouble with the NIP doctors. The NIP doctors on the whole were terrible. This NIP doctor, this particular NIP doctor, was hanged at the end of the war for the sort of things he did. He refused, for instance, to admit there was diphtheria. Now, I don't know whose face he was trying to save or why. He said, no, this is membranous tonsillitis. Well, that's absolutely correct, but it's membranous tonsillitis due to diphtheria. And there was no question of getting any diphtheria antitoxin or anything. He was the same fellow who said that there was no such thing as avitaminosis. Vitamins were a luxury, he said. Vitamins. The word vitae means life. A means vital amines. Yes, that was Japanese medicine. There were one or two famous cases there, I must admit. We had one amazing case. Young fellow called Cherry, I think his name was. He had one of the complications of diphtheria is peripheral neuritis, where you get paralysis, motor paralysis. And he developed paralysis. He could neither move his arms or legs. And eventually his diaphragm began to go too. And the trouble was, he also had dysentery. And he couldn't swallow properly because his pharynx was paralyzed. So when he tried to swallow, it went into his trachea or into his nose. Anyhow, it went the wrong place. So I think we did well there. I posted somebody at the top of his bed 24 hours a day. And we made up a concoction of, I think we could get date sugar, gula malacca it was called, it's sort of date sugar, and we could buy eggs and put some salt in, and we made a mixture of this sugar, protein and eggs, salt. And we only had a catheter for a bladder catheter, so we couldn't put a catheter into his nose, into his stomach. But long enough. So it only went halfway down his esophagus. So I put a bloke at the top of his bed, sat there, and we only had a 2cc syringe. So we took 2cc's syringe and then put it at the top of his catheter and pushed it down. And then it would push into it, it would go into his esophagus. And then you had to listen. And then when it went into his stomach, it went glug, 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 glug. Then you put the next lot, three or four, eight, and if you did it for 24 hours, of course, you got in 2 or 3 litres. Yes. And he lived. He lived. I thought, this is one of my great triumphs. I mean, you know, as a doctor, you can't often say that you really saved life. You're about when they recover. Or you're using a well-known technique for getting them better. It's not your, all right, you did the right thing. But it's an accumulation of previous people's work that you're passing on. That's fine. But just occasionally in life, about 2 or 3 times in life, you feel that, yes, it was me, I did it this time, you know. And that was one. That was the first time where I really felt that we had made a big difference there. Yes, he recovered. He recovered. He became a farmer, I think, in Sussex afterwards. Well, after a while in Chiang Kai, I don't remember much about the life in Chiang Kai apart from my work in the diphtheria ward.
What was the hospital like generally?
Oh, it was just an attap hut, that's right. Yeah.
And how many wards would there have been?
Oh, attap huts come in yards, you know. You can make one 100 yards long or one 20 yards long or 10 yards long.
It's just one big building, wasn't
it? It's just a roof over 2 sets of platforms. So there's no wall at the side, which is nice because the air circulates well. You're in the shade, you're out of the rain. You
so the diphtheria cases would have been
in a separate part.
I think
we had a small attap hut. Yes, I think so. I don't think it was even joined to another one.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, what were the resources you had in the hospital? You know, at that particular point.
We had almost no resources. I mean, we had, I think the surgeons had a few instruments, there's no question about that. There was a bit of chloroform, I know that, and ether, and that seemed to remain for quite a while. We had a bedpan, as you heard, and we always carried those around with us. We had facilities for giving intravenous stuff, so we must have some needles. But the biggest syringe, as you heard, that we had was 2cc's, 2 mL, pretty small. We must have had a few needles. We had bandages. Mainly bandages were people's old shirts and so on, which were washed and cut up. I don't think we had much. We had no dressings apart from that sort of thing. We bought from, you see, we were paid a certain amount, funnily enough, the officers. And we mostly spent that on passing it on or buying things. And we could buy from the Thais who came up with various goods. And one of the things they sold us was you'll hear about this later, was iodoform for the tropical ulcers. Tropical ulcers, it didn't really figure much, not in Chiang Kai, not at that time. So I leave that. What else was there about Chiang Kai?